From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Protect and serve is a well-known motto for law enforcement, a phrase that has long reflected the values of this act of public service. But what happens when an officer's bias gets in the way of that ethos? Do the consequences ever lead to termination? More than 19,000 complaints have been made between 2016 and 2024, alleging prejudiced behavior by California law enforcement and correctional officers. But only a small fraction of those complaints get investigated. And if they're vetted, they rarely lead to termination. A recent investigation by the California Newsroom and UC Berkeley's Investigative Reporting Program looked into what happened to law enforcement officers who engaged in explicitly biased conduct over the span of a decade and found they rarely lost their jobs. Emily Zentner is an investigative data journalist with the California Newsroom and joins us now with their investigation. Welcome back.
Thanks, Vicky.
So what sparked all of this? You diving in and looking into it?
We have a larger database that we released last year of police misconduct, use of force, and officer-involved shooting records in California. And as a part of that, we were actually hand-reviewing all of the misconduct cases to make sure that there was actually sustained, confirmed misconduct cases there, just to check what we were putting out there. And just in doing that, my co-reporter, Lisa Pickoff-White, and I just kind of were talking to each other, being like, I feel like I'm seeing a lot of cases here of officers using slurs or harassing people based on their race, their gender, their religion, their sexual identity. And so we just kind of looked at each other and we're like, we should look into this. And then we brought in our other co-reporter, Marnette Federis, and we're like, we just need to dive into these records and see what we can find.
Remind us what the Police Records Access Project is for those who haven't heard it before.
Yeah, so the Police Records Access Project is an effort that's been going on for years in California to request and collect and eventually publish, which we were able to achieve with this database, these misconduct, use of force, and shooting records that became available under new state law in California. There's a couple of state laws that then made some of these records public that were not available before. It's only certain levels of uses of force and certain types of misconduct. So we've been working for years to request those and put them out into the world.
Mm. When it comes to this recent investigation, was it easy? I would think it wouldn't be. I mean, just with everything you laid out, to get responses, information, documentation, kind of piece everything together to get a clear picture of what's happening.
You know, it really depends. There are some agencies that are posting this information online. There are some agencies that deliver it quickly. There are some agencies that do not deliver it so quickly. There are agencies that we've had to sue in order to get them to deliver this information for us. The other thing is, because there are these caveats on the law around what types of misconduct they do and do not have to share, and around the level of injury and a use of force that they do or do not have to share, agencies sometimes interpret that in different ways. So we also have ended up in situations where we're arguing with an agency saying, no, we've seen records that say that your officer's interaction with this person led to this outcome. And they're saying, no, that's not, that doesn't rise to the level.
Wow. Yeah, I can see why it's taken you a long time to just get a good picture of what you uncovered. So in your reporting, what are the main findings? What are the main things that you discovered?
So we uncovered around 140 officers between 2014 and 2024 who engaged in what we determined to be explicitly biased conduct. So those officers were using racist, sexist, and homophobic slurs. We found an officer who was mocking transgender people, a number of officers who were doing that, making violent or racist comments about Black people, demeaning members of the public or coworkers or incarcerated people based on these protected classes. So we found about 140 officers who were engaging in this behavior, and only about 12% of them were fired as a result of that conduct. Excluding corrections officers, more than 40% of those officers are still working in California law enforcement today. So only 12% were fired. Some have since left law enforcement through other circumstances, But currently, more than 40% of those officers, excluding correctional officers, are still police officers.
Okay, well, aside from termination, what other consequences are out there for these officers?
So there is a scale that kind of is somewhat standard from agency to agency. There may be slight variations, but you'll have things on the more minor end of things, like a letter of reprimand that gets placed in a file. And those sometimes disappear after a time. Officers may also be ordered to be retrained. They can be suspended. They can be demoted. They can have their salary reduced. They can be fired. Officers can also, be sort of pushed to resign in certain situations, or may decide to resign when these cases start. So that's kind of the broad spectrum of what discipline we sometimes see.
When you went into the weeds and looked at the cases of these more than 140 law enforcement officers, was there a range in severity of the language, the comments, the behavior used by these officers? And if so, who determines the right punishment, the right consequences for the act, if it is determined to be vetted and that it happened?
There absolutely is a range, and there's a range of, some officers who are maybe using a word or sharing a joke and then being disciplined and saying, "I didn't know that that was what that meant," to officers who are doing things with a bit more intention. We had about 23 officers who were found to be using the N-word, which is, something that our experts all noted as something that's a fairly severe and shocking thing for an officer to be doing. We found officers who were making violent threats online, and one officer who's making violent threats online against transgender individuals. And then, you have officers who are, maybe using some inappropriate words in the workplace amongst each other that, then maybe is a little bit less severe versus some of the behavior towards the public.
Okay, so which agency determines the standards of conduct for police officers?
It's interesting because California has the Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training, which determines some rules and regulations on what can happen. And that agency, also called POST, can also determine if an officer should be decertified or not. And if an officer is decertified, they can no longer work as a peace officer in California. So, on that sort of high statewide level, can you be a police officer? We have POST. But in the day-to-day workplace violations and discipline, that is up to individual agencies. They are setting that policy and they are deciding on that discipline.
In a particularly severe example that you use in your reporting, I mean, there was an officer who was going under a pseudonym on social media and, I mean, making violent threats against transgender individuals, even, I think, threatening to kill them, using past tense phrases. What happens to an officer in that situation? I mean, what was the outcome of that?
The outcome of that was an interesting one because there have been some changes to state law that could prevent situations like this in the future. But in that case, that officer was allowed to resign instead of being fired. And his resignation actually came with him signing an agreement with the department that allowed his disciplinary record to be sealed. And since leaving that department, he has gone on to work at two other departments in the Central Valley and is currently still a police officer in Wasco in the Central Valley. And that's something that experts brought up with us a few times, that if we are not, as a community, and law enforcement is not, as a profession, setting very clear guidelines on what is and is not acceptable for law enforcement officers to be doing, then you can have officers who are moving around. And I spoke with Cheryl Victorian, who is the police chief in Waco, Texas. And something that she really stressed is like how we move forward from this is just that law enforcement needs to be unified on this and say what is and isn't okay, so that if an officer is doing something like that, going online and threatening to harm members of the community, they are not then moving between departments because law enforcement as a whole has decided this behavior is or is not okay, and we're not going to allow it to continue.
And the experts that you spoke with, I mean, there is this term over-policing, under-protection, and it's a paradox. I mean, just unpack that a little bit and how this explicit bias, you know, when it is confirmed, but maybe the consequences don't rise to the severity of the action of the officer, how that in the long run can erode public trust in law enforcement and calling 911 when you actually need help.
Yeah, the over-policing, under-protection paradox is something that comes up particularly with communities of color and the LGBT community. And the idea is that there are communities that may have more of a law enforcement presence where police may be showing up there and engaging and in a negative way with the community more often, coming because a crime has been reported or an incident has been reported, but that there is a lack of trust there, either because of the behavior of the officers or even just because of that community's perception of the police and who they are there to serve. So that then if you are in a dangerous situation, if you need help, you're not going to call 911 because you do not trust who they're going to send and you don't trust that they're there for you. And that's something that experts brought up a lot, is that behavior like this, it's not just words, it's not just jokes. It sends a clear message to the community, again, about who police are here to serve. And if you don't feel like the police are here for you, those experts were saying that's not going to be who you call when you feel like you're in danger. So you end up with these communities where there may be more police presence than there are in other communities. The police may be getting called there more often, but the people who live in that community are not calling on the police for protection in the way that people in other communities might be doing.
You also learned that in the courtroom, I mean, this could also undermine court cases. It can undermine a prosecution because it affects police credibility. What did you learn?
Absolutely. This is something that we have seen happen in O.J. Simpson's trial. There was an LAPD officer who was one of the substantial witnesses in that case who was completely discredited due to some past racist behavior that had come out. And in the United States, under a Supreme Court decision, Brady v. Maryland, defense attorneys and the defense in a case has a right to any information that could impeach the credibility of an officer who is being called on to testify. And behavior like this, according to experts we spoke to, absolutely falls under that because it can color that officer's credibility, especially in regards to whatever group they were showing prejudice against. And we were not able to determine if these officers actually are or are not on Brady lists. We reached out to all of the district attorney's offices in the counties where we encountered these officers, and we were in most cases not able to get an answer about whether these officers were on the Brady list or not. But that's something that we have thought about in making these records public and in doing reporting like this, is that this is information that the public has a right to, and this is an information that defense attorneys have a right to, because it does, it impacts an officer's credibility in the court. And we spoke to one expert, Vita Johnson, who is a law professor at Georgetown University, who was saying, if an officer is not credible to testify in the court, and if they're using behavior like this, they maybe shouldn't be a police officer. You know, like they might just not have a place in this profession.
So we looked at how this could potentially impact communities across the state, also now inside courtrooms. Does this type of bias, when it exists, does it have an impact internally within a police department? Does it affect other officers, other personnel and colleagues?
It absolutely does. And we actually found that the majority of this behavior was occurring between officers, which may be in part due to the fact that it's not easy for the public to make complaints against police officers, but it's also not easy for other officers to make complaints about other officers. There can be a lot of fear of retaliation, but experts we spoke to said that this can really erode the trust within a police department. And especially if you are a police department that's trying to move towards being more community oriented, being more accepting of other races and identities, and trying to hire more diverse officers, this is something that can totally undercut that culture if then there are officers who are behaving this way. So we had experts who were saying that this kind of hinders some of the progress that departments may be working to make, in addition to being stressful and undermining trust between officers themselves.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with investigative data journalist Emily Zentner about cases of police and correctional officers showing explicitly biased behavior and what discipline they did or did not face. So how did police departments, other agencies respond to your findings?
We were not able to speak with any of the police departments who we mentioned by name in the story. The departments that we were able to speak with, you know, said that this is unacceptable and that they are working towards being, you know, a presence that can be protective and positive for everyone. But we did not have any police departments we spoke to who said, yes, let's sit down for an interview. But speaking with experts in law enforcement, like Chief Cheryl Victoria, and we also spoke with Richard Druyan, who is a former LA police commissioner, they highlighted this is not acceptable and that this is not acceptable behavior. There was a variance of what we do about it. You know, not everyone was like, we need to fire these officers, but everyone was united in the fact that something needs to change. There needs to be different training. There need to be harder standards. This needs to not be a thing where an officer can have a very serious misconduct case and then move to other departments without it following them. And something that Cheryl Victorian really stressed is that the underpinning of public safety and the underpinning of the mission of police departments is trust, and that you cannot police appropriately without the trust of the community. And that is something that came across in every interview I did, was that behavior like this at the core of it just breaks down that trust in a very severe way.
I'm also curious about the reliability of the data you were able to compile. So your investigation found over 140 cases over the span of a decade between 2014 and 2024 of explicitly biased conduct. But your reporting also found, I mean, people filed more than, you know, 19,000 complaints alleging prejudice behavior. However, agencies were only able to sustain like 349 of those complaints. So how reliable is 148 over the span of a decade? Is that an undercount?
Those 140 officers are absolutely an undercount from what we have heard from experts. There is a blue wall of silence that our experts brought up, where fellow police officers are not always going to be willing to report misconduct by other police officers, be that because there's a loyalty there or because there's a fear of retaliation if you're the person who speaks up and says, hey, this is going on. And for members of the public, it is not always easy to figure out how to file a complaint against a police officer. And there's also that fear of retaliation of, if I report what this person did, am I going to be safe? That is something, especially in correctional settings, which we also looked at in this reporting, that is a big thing. Are those inmates empowered and safe and able to make those complaints? So in addition to those around 19,000 complaints you mentioned, experts stressed to us that there are probably many of these incidents that are just not reported to anyone at the end of the day.
Finally, Emily, what should people take away from this investigation?
I think the important thing to take away from here is that this culture still exists in some police departments and that this behavior still exists in some police departments, and that seeing it and saying something is something that experts say is a way forward here. Starting to call it out, starting to have that conversation. And yeah, I think that is the big thing to take away from here, because these officers, many of them are still working. And there are, like we said, likely many other officers who have engaged in behavior like this where it has never been reported.
Emily, thank you so much for sharing your investigation with us.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Emily Zentner is an investigative data journalist with the California Newsroom. We've been talking about a recent investigation into cases of police and correctional officers engaging in explicitly biased conduct across California. We have a link to that investigation on our Insight page. Up next, business owners are sounding the alarm about a growing wave of lawsuits they face for allegedly violating the California Invasion of Privacy Act. A new bill looks to address the litigation, but advocates are concerned it could erode the privacy of Californians online. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.